I'm a pioneer.
Whoop. I have got the wrong. There we go. I am all kinds of discombobulated tonight. This is Pure Decking, show number 457 for Thursday, November the 11th, 1990. This is the show about stuff that interests me, like information security, rigging game, and the fact that I have recently learned that my age can be described as afraid to use spaces and file names. Madman, what's up?
Nothing much. Spent the day napping and watching UFO documentaries. Completely worthless.
I spent the day working on my laptop and working on a 3D printer build, which is actually looking like a printer, but I was replacing all the V-rollers on it because all the ones from my the source machine I was using for parts were all just... I mean, I knew that they needed replaced, but, oh, man, I didn't realize how far gone some of them were. So... And are you?
Well, so. I don't use spaces in file names. That's just fucking stupid.
I saw that one earlier that you can describe your age as, you know, being afraid to use spaces in file names. I'm like, yeah?
Yeah, it was stupid otherwise.
Shit
and
didn't
if you
work.
Spell your file names correctly or have anything in order, you're fucking stupid. Some say my stuff's encrypted. Others say I have dyslexia.
It's not encrypted so much as just I have really bad spelling.
That's true, dude. I've actually had someone say, is this encrypted? No, sorry, man. I can't spell for shit.
No, I couldn't afford any encryption software. So after I wrote my school papers, I just changed the font to Wingdings and then saved it.
Oh, dude, you'd hate my file names. Well, you'd know what they look like. They're fucking terrible.
Not encrypted, sir. It's encoded. There's a slight difference.
That would be a good way to screw with people, though. Misspell things in other languages. like not just in misspell it in English. Like, write all your file names in French and misspell them, you know?
Like, or have a French student do your Spanish homework and then turn it in.
There you go. What's this? It's a paper on cryptography. Wait, what? Anyways.
Well, here's an example of one file name here. BTOV2AE. Any idea what that one would be? About
say it again. BTO.
BITOV2A, and everything's in caps except for the A.
What's the extension?
It's just a notepad.
So I'm going to say it's a collection of links related to Bitcoin.
You're pretty close. It is links, but it's to a movie server.
Oh,
which is named something, but yeah. So nobody's really gonna have a fucking clue going through my files. I know what they mean, but others aren't gonna know.
Oh, that's all that matters. Well, my show template has had a typo in it. At least half the time we've been doing decking, it's just a text file, but it's been desking template for as long as I can remember now. So. Because I at some point I was typing decking template, wrote desking instead, and it never got fixed.
Yeah. Still part of the fun.
So, anyways, first first article tonight. It's from Ars Technica. These parents built a school app in the city called the Cops. So, to clarify a little bit, it's in Sweden. They They had this official website for a school that was like events and calendaring and all this other stuff. And apparently it was god awful. So one of the parents was a developer who started digging through their site, figured out their API, and wrote their own phone app. So the school has now reported them for hacking the website, for reverse engineering the API and making a better app.
That's not how hacking works.
Well, that's how old school hacking works. I mean, you mean the modern vernacular, no. Because he didn't steal anything or give you malware, or try to ransomware. But
I mean, are they taking money off the person who developed the app?
Nope.
Is that what it's about?
Nope. So they were telling people they'd get viruses for using it. Yeah, no, he put it on GitHub.
Wow.
Christian Landridge's police was running, or patience, or I can't say this. Let me try this again. Christian Landrin's patience was running out. Every day, the separated father of three was wasting precious time trying to get to the city of Stockholm's official school system, school platform, to work properly. Landrin would dig through the endless convoluted menus to find out what his children were doing at school. If working out what his children needed in their gym kit was a hassle, then working out how to report them as sick was a nightmare. 2 years after its launch in August 2018, the Skull platform had become a constant thorn in the side of thousands of parents across Sweden's capital city. Quote, all of the users and parents were angry, unquote, Langren says. The Skull platform wasn't meant to be this way. Commissioned in 2013, the system was intended to make the lives of up to 500,000 children, teachers, and parents in Stockholm easier, acting as the technological backbone for all things education, from registering attendance to keeping records of grades. The platform is a complex system that's made up of three different parts, containing 18 individual modules that are maintained by five external companies. Well, there's your problem. The sprawling system is used by 600 preschools and 177 schools with separate logins for every teacher, student, and parent. The only problem? It doesn't work. What a surprise. Of course, anybody who's used any school systems know how stupid these things get so very quickly. Being developed by multiple companies is probably a major part of the issue because everybody's going to have their own opinion on it. And then they start playing we're the only ones who understand how this module works, so that the contract doesn't ever go to anybody else game. The Skull platform, and I'm saying it that way, it's SKOLPLATTFORM. So, Skull platform, I mean, I guess I should be putting an accent on it, but I don't feel like the Muppet Chef, so, wasn't meant to be this way. Commission 2013 system, I think I read this, which has cost more than a billion Swedish krona, SEK, or 117 million, has failed to match its initial ambition. Parents and teachers have complained about the complexity of the system. Its launch was delayed. There have been reports of project mismanagement, and it has been labeled an IT disaster. The Android version of the app has an average 1.2 star rating. On October 23rd, 2020, Landgren, a developer and the CEO of Swedish innovation consulting firm iTeam, tweeted a hat design emblazoned with the words Skrota Skull Platform, loosely translated as Trash the School Platform. He joked he should wear the hat whenever he picked up his children from school. Weeks later, wearing the hat, he decided to take matters into his own hands. Quote, from my own frustration, I just started to create my own app, Landgren said. He wrote to city officials asking to see the school platform's API documents. While waiting for a response, he logged into his account and tried to work out whether the system could be reverse engineered. Just a few hours, he had created something that worked. Quote, I had the information on my screen from the school platform, he says. And then I started building an API on top of their lousy API. So he started writing glue code. He figured out what their system calls were just by examining the app and looking at the calls. Basically logging what was coming out of his web browser, right? And started writing his own interface on top of it. The work started at the end of November 2020, just days after Stockholm's Board of Education was hit with a 4 million SEK GDPR fine for, quote, serious shortcomings in the school platform. Oh, there's a name. Ingrid.
Oh, hold up. Did I just hear you say the government fined itself?
Yes. I think. Just days after Stockholm's Board of Education was hit with a fine. Let me follow the link here, if it's in English. Who fined it? The Swedish Authority for Privacy Protection. Yeah, so the Swedish government, one branch of the Swedish government fined the education branch of the Swedish government, yes.
Oh, that is retarded.
Yep.
Good news, guys. I moved money from my left pocket to my right pocket.
No,
I'm certain my left pocket is unhappy.
No, there's somebody in one department going, "Hey, guys, look, I found a way to steal budget from other departments."
It. Got to keep them competitive, see?
Oh, here we go with this. Now that I've put the... I think that's how you say that. That's a word.
Today we make the Swedish meatball.
I mean, the name of the Swedish data regulator is like 20 characters long and missing vowels. So I don't know how to say that. It's like, is that misspelled? I have no idea. Maybe. We were just talking about ways of encrypting things. Just make the names ridiculously long. The Swedish data regulator had found the serious flaws in the platform that had exposed the data of hundreds of thousands of parents, teachers, and children. In some cases, people's personal information could be accessed from Google searches. The flaws have since been fixed and the fine reduced on appeal. In the weeks that followed, Langren teamed up with fellow developers and parents, Johan Orbrick and Eric Hellman, and the trio hatched a plan. They would create an open source version of the school platform and release it as an app that could be used by frustrated parents across Stockholm. Building on Langren's earlier work, the team opened Chrome's developer tools, logged into school platform, and wrote down all the URLs and payloads. Yeah, that's how you do it. They took the code, which called the platform's private API, and built packages so it could run on a phone, essentially creating a layer on top of the existing glitchy school platform. The result was Opana School Platform, or Open School Platform. The app was released on February 12, 2021, and all of its code was published under an open source license on GitHub. Anyone can take or use the code with very few limitations on what they could do with it. If the city wanted any of the code, it could. You know, they could just take it. It's open source.
Yeah.
But rather than welcome it with open arms, city officials reacted with indignation. Even before the app was released, the city of Stockholm warned Langren that it might be illegal. Sure. They're calling
it
the same.
No, it's embarrassing.
Yeah.
It's embarrassing because a dude in an afternoon did what multiple companies couldn't get right in fucking 12 months.
Just my layman idea of what's going on here. So effectively, they wrote a program that just talks to the website for them and translates the stupid into something useful. It doesn't actually interfere with the website.
You're not too far off. So, I'm trying to think, how do I explain this without oversimplifying it? Because I don't want to oversimplify it to the point that it's wrong, you know?
Yeah.
APIs, generally, when you're talking web applications, are going to be a collection of what you would normally call URIs, but you would look at them and say that's a website address, that's a URL, right? So it's going to be an address on a server, and then there's going to be a specific way of calling that address, usually with something like a JSON or comma separated inputs. I've seen that. Some use their own query language, but generally, it's going to be something along the line of post information with headers or just flat out JSON or XML. So basically, it's a URL that you send structured data to, and it will return data in that same structure. The difference here is that you're not retrieving web pages like you would normally do with a URL, right? So you're making calls, and you're only getting a little bit of information usually in a structured manner back. So the idea there is, instead of loading a web page and interacting with the web page, I might have a web page that you load that's loaded up with JavaScript, and then all that JavaScript is calling these APIs in the background. So instead of my page refreshing every time I click something like it did back in the 90s and early 2000s, you know, modern web apps redraw the screen with JavaScript, and they're just pulling the data in on that initial page. So a web application, that initial page load is going to be loading all the JavaScript and all the code and, well, CSS and HTML and all that other shit in the background. And then it's going to be making calls to these APIs. So what he did was he wrote his own program to talk to the API instead of the front-end JavaScript that you would normally use to interact with the API. Clear as mud?
Clear as mud. I actually understand it.
Excellent. Okay. I'm going to assume I've explained that well enough. If not, well, you know, you all can do what I did and spend a few years learning to test web applications. So, good luck. But
I'm already an alcoholic, thanks. It's okay.
Yeah, speaking of, I've got a little bit of Knob Creek single barrel here. So, of course, I'm switching to water after I finish off this because... it's been brought to my attention that I might encourage heavy drinking. I don't, you know, don't really intend to, but maybe it might not be such a bad idea.
It made you a fucking role model.
I don't have an answer for that.
That's what I mean. How can you be encouraging people to drink if you're not a role model? People make their own choices.
Okay, I'll leave it at that. In the 8 months that followed, Stockholm's Stad, the city of Stockholm, attempted to derail and shut down the open source app. It warned parents to stop using the app and alleged that it might be illegally accessing people's personal information. Officials reported the app to data protection authorities, and Langram claims tweaked the official system's underlying code to stop the spinoff from operating at all. Then in April, the city announced it was getting the police involved. Officials claimed the app and its co-founders may have committed a criminal breach, criminal data breach, and asked cybercrime investigators to look into how the app worked. The move took Langren, who had been meeting with city officials to address concerns about the app, by surprise. So he was trying to work with them, and they called the cops on him.
Of course.
Quote, it was quite scary, he said of the police involvement. Upon a Stockholm... School platforming is not a complicated app. While the official school platform is built for everyone involved in education in the Swedish capital, 200,000 parents, 23,500 members of the school staff, and 140,000 students. I'll get numbers right eventually. Its open source alternative is just for the parents. The $1 app has been downloaded about 12,500 times on iPhone and Android and has about a 4.2-star average rating and only shows basic information. Parents log in using the Swedish digital identity system BankID, which is also used by school platformen. They can then see information about their children that's pulled into the app through the school platform API. The app shows school calendars and events such as music concerts, a daily schedule for pupils, notifications from teachers that link out grades, and news updates, food that's being served in cafeterias, and the option to report children are sick. Quote, everything that we display is open and public information, says Orbeck, one of the Opana school and platform co-founders. I'm just going to start saying open school platform because it's killing me trying to say the Swedish. He explained that the students' grades are shown. They are displayed through the in-app browser where the app can't access any data. One of the first iterations of the app included some parents' personal details, which are available through the official platform, but these were later removed. Quote, it was sort of an accidental success, Orbeck adds. We never anticipated that it would work as well as it did. He said that the Open School Platform team held meetings with the city in which they said officials could take their code and use their version of the app. Quote, they did not want to collaborate or even discuss collaboration with us. They just went on and reported us to the police, he said. Well, I can tell you why. They had contracts with all these other companies to make the app, and if they accepted this open source platform or in any way, basically these companies could come back and sue them for breach of contract. That's one of the reasons they're being so crazy about this. City of Stockholm was unsure about open school platform from the beginning. Quote, we do not have open APIs, so they made their own solution. Unquote. Helene Mossberg, the deputy head of digitization and IT at the city's education division, told the Swedish publication Ny Teknik in February. Mossberg, speaking before the unofficial app launch, said it may be illegal because people's personal data was involved. Although Mossberg claimed to be generally positive about the app, she said a, quote, rigorous investigation was being launched. The city encouraged the developers not to publish the app until the investigation was completed, official documents say. In mid-February, Swedish security firm Kretzea completed an external audit of the app. The report was not published, despite Sweden's strong transparency laws. And in order to access the document, Open School Platform team challenged the non-disclosure in court. 3 weeks later, at the end of February, the stakes were raised. The city said it was making security updates to School Platform to stop any potential personal data from being accessed, effectively shutting down Open School Platform's homebrewed API. The city's action started a tug of war between the two sides. The school platform would be updated. Open School Platform would respond with its own updates. In March, Open School Platform was apparently updated 7 times to avoid sabotage from the city, which continued to change its underlying systems. Quote, they were worried that their information was sent elsewhere, unquote, Langren says. Around this time, he claims, a dedicated task force was established to tackle the Open School Platform problem. Lena, okay, this goes on and on. Basically, they're going around and around in circles, and they're at loggerheads. But they're saying that, you know, eventually they got tired of it, and they've just kind of started ignoring it now. So, but yeah, I mean, if your platform has an open API on the back end, and you're not doing any kind of verification or any kind of tunneling or encryption or anything like that, there's nothing to prevent somebody else from writing a different front end to your web app. Now, I find this fascinating because, well, one of the common ways I would use to test web apps would be to either write my own code, usually in Python, to interact with a web app, because between Beautiful Soup and requests, you can do basically whatever the hell you want to a set of APIs in Python fairly easily, I would add. The other way to do it, and what I saw a lot of people I worked with use, was an app called Postman, which was kind of this packaged up application where you would feed it the URIs and what data you wanted to send, and it would just show you what came back. So if you weren't interested in writing code and you just wanted to test calls, you could use the Postman app to do it. And some people found that a little bit easier than, you know, popping open the command line and writing scripts, right? So, which, fair enough, whatever works. But, you know, I'm sure that's what these guys were doing, is they were just walking the API, figuring out what the data looked like when they did it in a web browser, and then figuring out how to make their own. And they made one that was much, much cleaner than the stock ones. Oh, the other reason a lot of websites will use an API for their back-end data rather than, you know, write a little front-end in JavaScript is for things like mobile apps. Because then the mobile app can access the same API back-end as the main web page and can access, you know, and you can have different apps for different platforms, that kind of thing. So that's the other reason to write things like that. And also, honestly, with modern development tools, writing APIs is easy. You know, there's lots of frameworks out there for doing it where you define the URI, define what data it's expecting, write out the code for what it does with that data, whether it's process it, pull, you know, use it to request information from a database, which is your 9 times out of 10 what it's doing, or, you know, pull the information from another platform. A lot of web chats will do things where they use an API and it's front-ending to like an IRC service on the back end, or not a database, but like a Redis server or some other messaging queue, that kind of thing. So, you know, there's all kinds of fun stuff you can do when you start writing code that way. But you need to understand that just because it's open for you doesn't mean it's not open for everybody else. And I understand why the school board was getting very concerned that somebody else was writing an app against their API, because as far as they were concerned, that was private and proprietary. The fact that it was out there on the internet for anyone to dig and discover manually didn't matter, even though You know, it totally does. So, you know, you just need to understand people are going to walk your shit and start figuring it out, especially if you made an interface that's so terrible that they feel like they need to make their own. So, I guess nobody else but me found that one fascinating.
No, I'm just wondering, should a company have a right to their code if it's publicly accessible? That's kind of the argument I'm thinking these companies are having is, this is our code. They don't have a right to build something around it without our permission.
No,
but
it's not.
They did, even though it's kind of, it is publicly accessible information.
Well, except it's not your code. I'm not accessing your code. I'm accessing your endpoint API. So what I'm doing is I'm saying, okay, I see that your application calls this particular address and sends this block of data. And usually you can look at the data and suss out what it is and where it got it, right? And so I'm going to do the same thing. And oh, look, I'm getting the data back that I would expect, so I can do what I want with it. So in the case of what this guy's doing, he's just pulling out all the calls that he thinks would be relevant for parents and just putting them in a cleaner interface so that it's easier and quicker for what they need to do. So I'm not looking at your code. I'm simply using the same interfaces that your code does, because that's how you decided to develop your back end to your application. The same trick, they used to do the same trick back in the day with just connecting to their database, especially if their database was open. You know, you make the same calls, get in their database and pull their data out, or, you know, SQL injection. But, you know, that's a different call. But, you know, it's the same thing. I'm talking to your server as though I'm your application. I'm using the same calls that your application would do. So does that help? Does that hurt with what you're thinking, Madman?
It helps a little bit.
And it is kind of confusing, because I can totally see where people who don't understand the intricacies of web design would think exactly what you're thinking. It's like, well, it's my code. What are you doing with my code? It's like, well, it's the calls your code makes. We're doing the same calls. We wrote all of our own code, you know? I'm just copying the URLs, but they're technically URIs, Uniform Resource Index.
Yeah.
You know, anyways, a resource index, but because it's you're not getting a web page off of it, but I don't know. This is how you have applications that, you know, they'll have a heavy client, a light web front end, and then mobile apps all hitting the same data set is through APIs, as opposed to just straight up data calls or database connections, because it lets you do a lot more with it. You know, maybe I don't want to talk to a database. Maybe I want to talk to a back end message queue, or maybe I want to talk to, I was looking at doing some game design a while back. You know, I was thinking I might put together my own web-based MMO and never did. But I was doing some of the design work on how you'd make it work. So, yeah, I was reading up on how to do a lot of this stuff. And, you know, so I understand perfectly what they've done. And I can see why the school is freaking out, because they don't understand that the companies they've contracted out are building this in such a way that other people can write front ends. Because that's really what it is they're writing their own front end for the school's back end.
And one crappy thing, I mean, these parents aren't using it for anything malicious, but if these guys didn't secure their code, then let's say it was allowed to access some a bit more private information, and they're not verifying who's actually talking to their database, that could be a bit of a problem.
Well, that's probably the other reason they're freaking out about it, is because if they're designing with this with the idea that they don't think anybody else is going to be digging through their URIs and making calls to their system, they're probably not writing a very clean API, right? So they very, very well may have serious security flaws like that, like what you're describing. because they're assuming nobody else is going to go dicking around in there. And so that's probably the other reason they're panicking, is because they're realizing that this could legitimately create data exposures that they didn't know what to do with, especially since at the beginning of the story, they were talking about getting a huge data fine for it, or fine from their, you know, the Swedish government. It was fining itself over it. So that absolutely could be the case. Moving on.
Moving on.
All right, next article is from Vice. Robinhood hackers accessed internal tool for removing account security features. Screenshots show. Because the article earlier this week was that somebody got in and dumped a bunch of information out of Robinhood. Robinhood told Motherboard that based on its investigation, the hackers did not make any changes to customer accounts. If they're in the admin tool, how do you know? They could have turned the
They keep off. Proper backups, and they looked at the backup that they made the day before this happened. And nothing had changed. That's how they know this, Morps.
Actually, comparing snapshots is a legitimate forensics tactic. It's not the easiest way to go, but it is one you can do. I mean, sure, we can pull up all the files from yesterday to today and, you know, run them against fucking diff and look at the differences and hope to catch it in a very large, very busy system. Good luck, but I mean, that is one way to do it. The hackers behind the recent breach of customer data from app-based broker Robinhood had access to an internal tool that presented them the option of tampering with user accounts, including removing specific users' multi-factor authentication protection, according to screenshots of the tool obtained by Motherboard. Robinhood said that based on its investigation, the hackers did not make any changes to any customer accounts, however. The news highlights the potential risk that hackers can pose beyond simply stealing sensitive data. The screenshots of the tool also show buttons for logging a user out of their account, adding a trusted device, and blocking certain sessions from accessing the Robinhood account. The screenshots also show the hackers could view sensitive information on users, such as their balances and trades. A source who presented themselves as a proxy for the hackers provided Motherboard with the screenshots. And they've got screenshots of the internal tool here, right here in the thing, and they blocked out most of it, but... Yeah, it's a complete back-end tool for the Robinhood app. I mean, it looks like a, you know, any other admin dashboard you've ever seen, right? So, and you might think, well, why would they have the ability to remove multi-factor from accounts? Well, how do you think the support people do it if you have to call up and have your multi-factor removed? Because most people's multi-factor these days are their phones. And, you know, it doesn't take very long of looking around on YouTube at compilations or, you know, pick any other site where people post videos of themselves being stupid to see the number of people who break, lose, throw, flush down the toilet, or otherwise destroy their cell phones. Right? So what do? They got to call up the company and say, hey, my multi-factor is my phone. I've lost it. I need to reset it. So when they reset multi-factor, what they're really doing is just taking multi-factor off so that you can go, you know, re-add it on your new device when you've, you know, bought your replacement cell phone, right? So they were in the full admin tool, the back-end support tool. In an email to Motherboard, a Robinhood spokesperson said that certain authorized Robinhood employees have the ability to update accounts as necessary to provide customer support or service accounts, and as is the standard at most financial institutions and platforms. And it is. You know, generally you'd hope they have better control over it so that hackers don't get into the back-end systems, but, you know, they have to have these kind of tools. And it's not that I...
Hello, Internet.
All right. I don't know where we lost the conversation, and we had that last part like twice there. So.
Next story spliced together.
Just next story? All right. Yeah. So they were in the back-end admin panels for Robinhood, but they also leaked a whole bunch of data. So kind of expected that they were in pretty deep into the system, right? Let's see. Next article is from Torrent Freak. Denovo protected games rendered unplayable because the domain name expired. Whoops. last evening, the web was alive with angry players who couldn't play their games due to an unexpected error. While the situation is still not completely clear, it appears that someone allowed a domain used by Denovo's anti-piracy technology to expire, meaning that players of some big games couldn't enjoy what they had paid for. One of the great ironies of anti-piracy technology is that they not only offer zero benefits to paying customers, but when things go wrong, the pirates are often better off. What appears to be a classic example of this topsy-turvy relationship emerged last night in a long complaints thread on Steam. Players who had legitimately bought Marvel's Guardians of the Galaxy found that it was impossible to play the game since it wouldn't load. The problem seemed to appear after players updated the game, leading some to believe that code may have broken the game. However, as more and more complaints came in, another potential problem was identified. It was so simple as to be almost unthinkable, but devastating in that it rendered the games completely useless. After complaining to Guardians of the Galaxy support, one Steam user obtained acknowledgement from the company that the problem was indeed server-side, which is quite the annoyance for a single-player game. Quote, unfortunately, I don't have an estimated time for resolution, but our team is working on it, unquote, the response reads. Quote, I'm expecting a fast resolution. The issue seems to be on our side, which we will publish more information on our official media, unquote. At the same time, some users resorted to uninstalling the game and re-downloading it to see if that made a difference, and it didn't. PC restarts failed to resolve the problem. Then it became clear that other games were affected too. Planet Zoo, Shadow of War, Football Manager, Dead Rising, Tomb Raider, and others. All appeared to have at least one thing in common, Denovo DRM. So, someone forgot to renew a domain, apparently. With the problems now affecting a large number of users, the complaints invariably spread to Twitter, where one eagle-eyed user explained what he believed had happened. According to Alex Buckland, the DRM provider for all of the affected games had let a key domain expire, rendering the system inoperable. Quote, at Planet Zoo Game, at Shadow of War Game, your DRM provider has let their domain names lapse. It's killed your game's startup along with multiple other games, I imagine, he wrote. Or, unquote, he wrote. Buckland identified the domain coldfusion.technology as the culprit and offered a screenshot of the Whois records, which clearly shows the domain expired on September 24th, 2021 and had not been renewed. Following the failure to renew, the domain went into a grace period, but when that expired too, which would have been, well, I guess that depends on the provider, it appears to have been removed from DNS records, which meant that the domain would not resolve to an IP address, effectively breaking the system. To solve the problem, some users on Steam posted tutorials to modify their host's file to point to the last known IP for the domain. This appeared to do the trick, but obviously such drastic measures shouldn't be needed to play a game that was legally purchased, especially those that are single-player only. Given that the above is just one side of the story, Torrent Freak contacted Denovo owner Irado to discover how they viewed the problem, whether they were ready to, really to blame or someone else. And that proved fruitless, so obviously they just didn't respond. After sending a set of questions to two of our usual contacts at the company, we received a pair of automated emails saying that our correspondence was undeliverable, but the messages had been bounced by administrator and as a result had permanently failed. It seems unlikely that it's part of the same problem, but it appears that Denovo does have some communication problems right now. They'll update the article if they ever get a response. In the meantime, someone has now renewed the CodeFusion.technology domain, which has solved the problems, but it's set to expire on September 24th, 2022, meaning just a single year was renewed. So... DRM on games is a bad idea. I mean, this is an old argument, but people who pirate the games, they just strip the DRM out of the game 9 times out of 10. So, especially for single player shit, I mean, you know, it shouldn't even need to contact a server to play, let alone...
Yeah, it's ridiculous.
But, yeah, so the pirates are going to strip the DRM out of the game anyways, and I realize a lot of these DRM companies market themselves as, oh, our DRM can't be removed. They're going in with hex editors and just putting NOP slides and shit like that around your DRM checks. And whereas some games do go pretty overboard with constantly challenging to ensure that the DRM is working, they tried some of that, you know, a while back in the Pentium 4 era, and they took games that were, they basically made games unplayable with the amount of DRM they put in them because of how much they'd slow machines down. There were guys who were testing the pirated versions and getting like 10 more FPS than the uncracked ones because the DRM wasn't running in the background, chewing up resources constantly. What was that game? Was it Spore? No, it wasn't Spore. I don't remember what the game it was, but it was a game that was actually significantly sped up by just removing the damn DRM because it was so aggressive in doing all the DRM checks that it was actually slowing systems down. There was another one where like the DRM was actively like bricking machines, but I'm blanking on this because it was in the 90s. There was the CD one where they installed a CD driver. I don't know, it's been too long.
Yeah, no, it's too long for me.
But I do know, especially going back and looking at the emulation scene, DOS, Amiga, all the stuff they got preserved wasn't the commercial copies of the games. It's all the cracked and pirated ones. So, just saying, for archive purposes, the pirated stuff seems to be what lives on past the initial life of a system. So, I think going DRM-free is the correct way to go, and just making it so that for most people, pirating the game is more of a hassle than just buying it on a legitimate platform. So, I mean, seriously, it's one of the reasons Steam is so damn successful, is because it's easier just to pay the $20 for a game than go hunt down shit in pirate sites, right?
Oh, yeah. So, easy.
Well, piracy wasn't really as... Big draw wasn't as much the convenience, because you could always go and pay the cash for the game. GameStop isn't new. Retailers aren't new. People pirate because it's free and convenient.
Well, and largely, you also have to remember, when it comes to piracy, you know, of course, the industry will always count any pirated copy as a sale they should have gotten. But that's not the case. You know, just like with movies and books and music, they're assuming anyone who ever pirated a copy of it would have bought a legitimate copy otherwise. But, you know, most of the people who are pirating stuff are either, you know, broke kids who don't have any money, or people who don't have the money to spend on thousands of dollars worth of movies, books, and software every month, right? So, yeah, I mean, if they're pirating it, it's, you know, it's got to be doable to do it, but it's probably because you've priced them out of your you know, product base. It's like if your game is $60 for the base plus, you know, another $60 in add-ons just to be able to play online, you think people aren't going to pirate that? Because most kids don't have $60 to spend for every game out there, but they still want to try them. And most game companies don't do the free demos like they used to do. Used to be, you could get a demo shareware version of the game. You know, Doom, the original Doom was a shareware game. Descent, Duke 3D, I mean, all this stuff had, you know, demo levels and stuff like that. But
well, they if quit. You're going with wanting to just try the game, at least for consoles, and even the modern consoles, You can legally play them free by going to your local library and checking them out.
Not a lot of people know that. Good to know, though. So, but yeah.
Yeah, cost for piracy, cost hasn't been a thing for a while. It's, well, the pricing you out of the market, I don't think is a very great argument for at least console games. PC games might be a bit different because you can't check them out. But how many PC games are exclusive PC these days?
Well, my point is that just because somebody's pirated something, that doesn't mean that otherwise they would have purchased a legitimate copy. That was my point.
I'll look and see that because I've been given movies that I would have never bought. Like, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. A friend of mine bought it. We watched it. He's like, yeah, this is nothing like the book. And handed me his copy of Hitchhiker's Guide. I would have never bought that movie. Not in my collection. But if you're going with losses, I kick in your door and steal your gun just because I wouldn't have bought it doesn't mean that you didn't get something taken. Or didn't lose profit on it.
Well, that's true, but the difference there is if you kick in my door and take my gun, I no longer have a gun. Whereas if you go onto a pirate site and steal my and get a copy of my software, you're not preventing anyone else from having a copy of that software, legitimate or otherwise.
Well, we'll go with an older school. Pirating books has been a thing for a while.
That's true.
Every author, if you don't actually buy their book, they can't afford to write. If, who wrote The Raven? Edgar Allan Poe. If people actually bought his books when he was alive, he would have been alive longer to write more books.
So, I mean, that's true. That's true. I'm just saying not all pirated copies would translate to sales, and the DRM makes a lot of people less likely to buy a game because, well, you get shit like this.
Well, I see the downside of DRM is it doesn't do what it's supposed to do. And another problem that's coming up with at least this story, what happens when the Guardians of the Galaxy's servers cease to exist? If it's for a single-player game, why can't I run it locally?
Because they're so worried about people stealing the game that they have made it so that it's tied to the existence of these online servers.
That's going to be a problem because I think you're fucking people over when you buy a legit single-player game and then one day you won't be able to play it. Well, I can slightly understand MMOs because I'm paying for the experience of playing with other people. But a single-player game, I don't see the argument for me not being able to just play it on my own equipment.
Well, there's a very good example of that came up earlier this year, and that's with the Sony PlayStation 3. The way they have the systems set up with achievements, it has to have the system clock set. But the only way to set the system clock is for it to synchronize with PlayStation servers. Well, as you get farther out, eventually, Sony is going to want to shut the servers that service the PlayStation 3 down in favor of their newer consoles, you know, whatever they're up to at the time they decide to do it. Which means even though your games are on disk and most of them will work just fine with that internet connection, because of the way they structured achievements, if the console clock gets reset and can't connect back to the PlayStation store with support for that console, they weren't going to be able to launch games. It would not launch games because the clock wasn't set correctly. And it was mainly to prevent people from cheating achievements, from what I understand. I'd have to go back and reread the articles and some of the stuff that came out about this. Now, I think Sony issued a patch because people were losing their mind about this. But, you know, as these consoles get older, especially the internet-connected ones, this is going to be a real concern that, you know, if I go into a pawn shop or on eBay, or like, okay, I've been doing stuff with old Game Boys lately, right? I'm childhood Game Boy, 30-year-old Game Boy. I can stick a game I had in it from back then. It still fucking works, no problem, right? But if I take a, I don't know, Xbox X, PlayStation 5, wait 30 years, then try to play a game on it, it's going to say, sorry, I can't connect to the servers, and just not let you do anything. You know, you won't be able to, you won't have a retro gaming scene for a lot of these modern internet connected consoles, because without the servers, they ain't going to work. So unless somebody builds, you know, open source clone servers that you could run in your house or stand up with a group of friends on the internet and find a way to redirect all the calls from the official stuff over to the clone servers, you're not going to be able to play them. So mod chips and well, what these companies would define as piracy is going to be the only way to keep them working eventually. So the whole archival aspect of playing these games, you know, yeah, today when we talk about archiving old games, I'm mostly talking about the 8, 16, even into the early 32-bit console stuff, but you know, eventually somebody growing up now is going to say, you know, when I was a kid, we played PlayStation 5 and had this game, and I don't even know what the modern games are, and they'll want to dust it out of the attic and play it, and it won't fucking work because the servers will be long gone. So, yeah, you're right. You're purchasing things that when they decide to shut the servers down, they're now worthless. Unless somebody hacks them, which I do have. Did I drop that? I think I did. No, I didn't. I've got it. Okay. I've got a story about the PlayStations later.
I don't know how many people view it the same way I do, but if a company's not going to respect your property rights, I don't see a reason why you should respect theirs. If I buy a game, because
they
have the right
more lawyers than
my
we do.
Game. Yeah.
So that's it. That's the only
legally
reason.
Legally, they're wrong. They can just bankrupt me. But if they're going to complain about us pirating, then they need to respect our rights to own what we purchase. And then I can respect their rights to own what they produce.
See, you're assuming you're an equal argument, you know, that you're at equal footing with this argument, and they don't.
Consumers, and the way capitalism works is the consumer is equal to the producer. We both have to come to an agreement for me to get your product.
I'm just saying that that's how they see it. So
yeah, it is how they see it. And that's one reason they're going to be seen as villains.
Speaking of companies seen as villains, this next one's from Ars Technica. Apple will no longer break Face ID on repaired iPhone 13s. So when the new iPhones dropped, some of the right to repair people were buying, and I watched some of these videos. They went and bought two identical models of iPhone 13 and swapped the screens to see what they did. And when they swapped the screens, like identical screens, just off two, you know, just two iPhone 13s, right? Face ID quit working. A bunch of the security stuff shut down. Basically, it's because the part has a serial number on it, and as soon as the serial number no longer matched, it would just brick a whole bunch of features of the phone, assuming it hadn't been repaired correctly or that it was pirate, or I don't know all the reasoning. Apple says it will back off its plan to break Face ID on independently repaired iPhones. The company's often contentious relationship with the repair community was tested again when, quote, unauthorized, unquote, iPhone 13 screen replacements started resulting in broken Face ID systems. A new report from The Verge says that Apple will release a software update that doesn't require you to transfer the microcontroller to keep Face ID working after a screen swap. Go ahead.
Newspeak sucks. They don't know that these people are unauthorized. If I say, hey, dude, here's $50, fix my phone, the dude is fucking authorized to fix my phone.
No, you know, authorized by Apple to fix your phone.
That's my damn phone. Apple can't authorize shit about it.
You remember what I was Fuck just Apple. Saying about how companies don't view you as an equal partner in this?
They're wrong, damn it. Leave my damn phone alone. And it's not the company on this one. It's the person writing the damned article.
No, that is what Apple calls them. Yeah. They have an authorized repair program where you sign the paperwork that you'll do things the way Apple wants you to do and use the parts Apple wants and a whole bunch of stuff that makes it very difficult to compete.
Then the correct phrase would be Apple authorized. The dude's still authorized.
Screen replacements are the most common smartphone repair. Apple included a new microcontroller in the iPhone 13's display that pairs each screen with other components in the phone. As iFixit reported, if a third-party repair shop replaced the iPhone 13 display, Apple would disable the phone's Face ID system. The repair community has started calling this part dependency trend serialization. Basically, each protected component reports a serial number to the OS, and the software keeps track of the serial numbers the device is supposed to have. If you swap out one part, one of the serial numbers will change, and the OS will know about it. In the case of third-party iPhone screen replacements, the phone would say unable to activate Face ID on this phone. Now, that said, Apple did have an argument when it was the fingerprint reader that was integrated into the screen that was also getting swapped, because they were saying that potentially somebody could be trying to stick a device between the fingerprint reader and the motherboard of the phone to get around the data protections. But Face ID is a 3D scanner and camera system. It's pretty damned complex. I'm not saying you couldn't insert a device in between them, but I think the camera's separate from the screen now. I'd have to go back and watch. Maybe it's all part of the same assembly, but I think they're still separate parts. You know, I might be wrong on that. I'd have to go back and look. But that was their official reasoning for disabling the security system after, you know, a part change, is they assumed that somebody was, they said, well, somebody could be trying to, you know, hack into the phone, so this is a security measure. Authorized repair shops have access to proprietary Apple software that pairs a new display microcontroller with the rest of the phone to re-enable Face ID. It's possible for unauthorized shops to swap the display microcontrollers, but that's a dramatic increase for the work, as most common phone repair requires a microscope, and requires a microscope and delicate desoldering work. I don't know if you guys have ever seen the kind of tiny surface mount soldering we're talking about here, but this is like tweezers, hotter rework, and hope. You know, if you're trying to do this without a pick and place and you know, a computer controlled temperature bed. Most circuit boards, modern circuit boards with surface mount components, they're not actually designed to be serviced. They're designed to be throw it away, replace it when it doesn't work, because whereas you can rework them with hot air, a soldering iron, and tweezers, and a microscope, the components aren't designed for that. They're designed to be placed by a pick and place, and then have the whole board heated at once with you know, a layer of solder paste or whatever. Or the other way they usually do it is they have all the components on the board and they run it through a solder bath with a waveguide solder machine, if I believe is what it's called. But yeah, it's these things are designed to be assembled by machine and never serviced after that. Not really. Well, service being just swapping component parts, but yeah. Anyways, dramatic increase in work, most common repair. Face ID in the iPhone 13 is an entirely different component from the display, so I was right about that. But there are no clear there's no clear justification for locking Face ID after a display swap. In the end result, though, according to iFixit, was an unprecedented lockdown that gives Apple the ability to approve or deny each individual repair. After a wave of bad press, its crisis is averted for the repair community. It'd be nice if this was never an issue in the first place. So, yeah, I can think of some reasons why Apple might think that's a good idea, but none of them really fly very far. So, I don't get it. You know, what's other than just trying to enforce the whole you're going to get it fixed with us or somebody we've authorized to fix it.
It's the whole you don't own what you buy from us.
Yeah.
Fuck them.
Yeah, you're right. Any thoughts on that, are you, other than your usual?
No, I'm just sort of thinking we're only about halfway through the show, aren't we? I got to get out of here, man. I'm going to be late for something if I stay much longer.
You're fine. So truckload, well, you know, because with the show dying, we're already at the hour, even though, yeah, I've got three stories.
Yeah, I could
and
only do the
left.
Hour this week.
So
yeah.
If you need to drop, drop. It's cool, dude.
All right, man. I'm sorry about that. I'll catch you guys tomorrow.
All right.
Take it easy.
Later.
Are you 486 disconnected from your channel?
All right. Well, I guess we will keep going. Let's blaze through the last ones. Truckload of GPUs stolen on their way out of San Francisco. This is from the Register. U.S.-based NVIDIA partner EVGA has reported that a shipment of GPUs it was sending to a distribution center has been stolen from a truck. A forum post by EVGA project manager Jacob Freeman states, please take notice that on October 29, 2021, a shipment of EVGA GeForce RTX 30 series graphics cards was stolen from a truck en route from San Francisco to our Southern California distribution center. These graphic cards are in high demand and each has an estimated retail value starting at $329.99 up to $1,959.99 MSRP. That's MSRP. Nobody is selling graphics cards at MSRP right now unless you get extremely lucky and catch them in stock. These things are getting scalped for twice or three times their MSRP. So that's one of the reasons why I just bought this laptop I did. The laptop with the GPU I wanted was cheaper than just buying the damn GPU. It's because it's a mobile chip and it's not quite as powerful as the desktop equivalent. But it'll do what I want, so I'm just going
That's
with it.
That's kind of sad.
I know. Well, and the worst thing is, I was waiting forever before, because I was thinking I was going to build a new rig, and it's like, well, the chip shortage has got to get better sometime soon, right? Nope. Between supply chain, chip shortage, prices aren't coming down anytime soon. So it's like, yeah, it's been a terrible time to buy a computer, but it's not getting better anytime soon, and I kind of do need a new machine. Current rig is getting on 6 years old and having some issues, so you know, kind of stuck. Anyways, which probably explains the motivation for the crime. Either someone hopes to resell them or a crypto miner has just built a price cut rig. Freeman's post doesn't say how many GPUs were stolen or if the truck was carrying anything else. He did, however, warn that buying stolen property is a crime, as is concealing, selling, or withholding purloined goods. He then appears to lay a trap of sorts by pointing out that attempts to register products that aren't stolen will succeed on a page that requires registration. Crooks are probably smart enough to use fake details when registering. They also are smart enough to use a VPN and or Tor to hide their tracks, right? So they've set up an email address. They're hoping for tips. The real problem with this is that, like what I was talking about, it's a scalper's market right now for high-end GPUs and game systems and things, right? So if I'm buying a GPU on the scalper's market on eBay or Craigslist or whatever, I have no way of knowing if it's stolen or not. And and there was another article that EVGA is going to be flagging the serial numbers of the stolen cards, so that if you try to register them, that you know they'll get notice, right? You may not know it's stolen if you're buying it secondhand on eBay. Now, sure, you'll have receipt and all that from buying it, but still. So, it's another good reason to avoid the scalper's market. You don't know if you're buying stolen goods, but, you know, for a lot of people, that's hard to do right now. If you want a high-end GPU, they're really hard to grab.
And odds are you're not buying one of the stolen ones.
Probably not. But I'm just wondering, was this a Fast and the Furious-style truck heist, or is this, you know, something a little bit easier where somebody just, you know, grabbed a crate off the truck when it was in a shipping dock or something, you know?
I'm hoping it was a Fast and Furious style truck heist, but the most successful truck heists I know of aren't that exciting. Here's a sad but true fact. The loading docks for most retailers aren't that secure, and steal a shit ton of crap, all you need is a CDL and a driver's and a semi. Or the boss to just drive one without training. Pull up and drive away with your truckload of merchandise.
catch them when they've got them, you know, with, because usually trucks will, semis will unhitch from their load, leave it docked.
Yep.
And so, yeah, you could just run off, hitch it and leave. And you, I mean, granted, they've got cameras everywhere, so they'd see them doing it, but I'm sure you could get creative and, you know, then you're into criminal territory, but
criminals, cameras aren't guards.
Yeah, you get pictures of the people who stole your stuff, and if they're all wearing, you know, cowboy hats and bandanas, the, you know, other than saying, why are all these people wearing cowboy hats? It's like, well, they were going for a meme. It also blocks their face from the camera, you know? But stolen license plate or something for the truck. But
or ditch the truck when you're done.
Yeah, I mean,
maybe the truck. Yeah, steal the truck from its parking spot. Ditch it when you ditch the container.
Find out someplace where you know somebody parks their semi for the night. And well, a lot of truckers sleep in their cab. But I was gonna say, you steal the cab, go do your heist, put the cab back. It's a dick move, though, isn't it? Because then some poor trucker is going to get in trouble when they find it. Okay, that's enough of that. But, yeah, I mean, I could see people pulling that off. It just reminds me of, you know, early days working for a company that did shipping. We didn't have the little truck thing to move semis around. So, but we had a couple of shippers that insisted that they had in their records that we did. So they'd always call up, can we just drop trailers with you? I'm like, no, because we can't move them when you do that. Well, we have on a record that you accept that. Well, your record is wrong. Well, but that's what the record says. So we need to drop this shipment and then, you know, he's going to leave. I'm like, nope, we won't accept it if you do that. And yeah, these guys got pushy. They thought they were going to get you to accept what they were saying. You know, it's like, no, you don't understand. I can't move it if you do that. We had one pull it. We had one do it, even though we told them not to. That was fun. That went up a few layers of management, and I believe the regional office threatened to sue them. Lost productivity and all this other shit.
Oh, yeah, because no one else could get into your yard depending on where he dropped it.
Basically, yeah. It caused all kinds of problems because they left it in the dock. Basically, they undocked from it while we were unloading the parts and left. And it's like, okay, well, we've only got two truck docks and, you know, we needed them both. So it's kind of sucked. You know, called them to come back and get it. And they said, well, we have in our records. I'm like, we've asked you to correct that how many times? So, major pain in the ass.
Next story. Yeah, Fast and Furious.
Next story is from Ars Technica. I was talking about this a minute ago where we mentioned the PlayStation. Hacking group says it has found encryption keys needed to unlock the PS5. Hacking group Fail Overflow announced on Sunday evening that it had obtained the encryption root keys for the PlayStation 5, an important first step for any effort to unlock the system and allow users to run homebrew software. The tweet announcement included an image of what appears to be PS5's decrypted firmware files, highlighting code that references the system secure loader. Analyzing that decrypted firmware could let Fail Overflow or other hackers reverse engineer the code and create custom firmware with the ability to load homebrew PS5 software. The update to the article is, aside from symmetric encryption decryption keys that have apparently been discovered, separate asymmetric keys are needed to validate any homebrew software as authentic by the system. The private portion of those authentication keys does not seem to have been uncovered yet, and probably won't be found on the system itself. Still, the symmetric keys in question could prove useful for enabling further analysis of the PS5 system software and discovering other exploits that could lead to the execution of the unsigned code. Extracting the PS5 system software and installing a replacement both require some sort of exploit that provides read and or write access to the PS5's usually secure kernel. Fail Overflow's post does not detail the exploit the group used, but the tweet says that the keys were obtained from software, suggesting the group didn't need to make any modifications to the hardware itself. Separately this weekend, well-known PlayStation hacker TheFlowZero tweeted a screenshot showing a debug settings option amid the usual list of PS5 settings. A console hacking news site Wululu explained this debug setting was previously only seen on the development hardware, where the GUI looks significantly different, but TheFlowZero's tweet appeared to come from the built-in sharing function of a retail PS5, suggesting he had also used an exploit to enable the internal flags that unlock the mode on standard consumer hardware. TheFlowZero added that he has no plans for disclosure of his PS5 exploit at this point. In recent years, TheFlowZero has taken part in Sony's bug bounty programs that reward the responsible disclosure of security flaws. So he's hoping for a payday, and I don't blame him. Yeah. So, anyways, they're working on the PS5, so if they're already getting some of the codes out of it, maybe we'll see homebrew and archiving of games and all that like we were talking about yet. And the final article I have for tonight, just to kind of burn through it here, is from Android Authority, although there's several sources of it. YouTube is removing dislike counts for all videos. Basically, on YouTube videos, you'll still have the dislike button, but you won't be able to see the ratio or the counts anymore. So they're hiding upvote, downvote on videos, which must mean that people aren't happy with seeing their ratios. That's all I can think. The bullet points in the article, YouTube is making dislike counts private across all videos on the platform. Users can still click the dislike button on videos, but the dislike counts will no longer be shown, and the change is going to be rolling out today. So they're hoping it will curb online harassment.
Why have it then? The reason I thought it was there so I can look and see, is this actually a video worth watching?
Well, according to YouTube, it's because you're using it wrong, you racist prick.
Well, just because I'm a racist doesn't mean I don't want to know if the video's good.
So, anyways.
I can also have decent time management.
Yep. It's like, you're not allowed to say anything that's not nice. You have to accept everything and just say only nice things.
It's the internet. I've been called a homo since before I knew what homosexuality was.
Last thing I have for you tonight, and then the only thing in Digital Dojo, is a pretty nice little program I've been playing with lately called WinArrow Tweaker. Pretty much, this is a big Windows 10 customization tool. I think it supports 11 now, too. You can go through and enable, disable certain animations, features of Windows, Windows Update, block telemetry. I've been using it in conjunction with Shut Up 10 on my new machine, for one thing. But, I've been playing with it for a bit, and it's got all kinds of nice little tweaks and stuff in it, but you know, for just kind of cleaning up and lightening up your Windows install, especially if you've got stuff you're wanting to turn off, like all the ads, all the suggestions and tips and shit like that. It's a nice little tool and kind of makes it easy to go through and make a bunch of tweaks to your Windows system. So it's definitely one worth looking at. And, so are you already absconded? So, Madman, closing thoughts.
When did anyone think it was a good idea to have my OS try to fucking sell me shit?
Microsoft's marketing team, circa 4 years ago.
Well, it annoys me. I actually have a sheet of paper next to my computer, and if I get an ad too many times, I make it a point not to buy the product. When it comes from my OS, I think other advertising doesn't bother me.
I mean, I think that's a perfectly valid thing to do. In fact, I think it's probably a good idea to do the whole boycott thing for anything you see advertising on platforms that should not be advertising. I think that's a good idea. It's like, oh, I see your company is advertising on Windows. Windows is being invasive with their advertising, so we're not going to do business with you because you're doing business with them. Yeah, I could see that.
Yeah. I mean, I'm fine with radio commercials. I know they're supposed to exist. You pay for free shit somehow. I actually paid for this copy of Windows.
Did you pay for the copy of Windows, or did it come with your computer?
Paid for this copy of Windows. I built this computer. It came with nothing.
Yeah, so the whole Microsoft putting ads in your system is kind of kicking the dick, isn't it?
Yeah, unless they're giving me the fucking ad money. It's like, here's $25 this month for the ads we've shown you.
But they would argue it was an unrealized revenue stream, and you know their shareholders required them, and blah, 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 blah. So.
Yes, that was ransoming out children, but you don't go around kidnapping for that.
All right.
For real, parents get really attached to those little crying bastards. I mean, don't get me wrong, some of them are cute a lot of the time, but they're also annoying. But people get attached to them. You steal a few of them, and for some reason, parents will pay to get them back. It's an unrealized revenue stream. Microsoft, you can look into this and, you know, continue down your treadmill to hell.
There you go. All right, that's all I've got for tonight. Listen to the stream while I was working on it. Peer Decking every Thursday, the Galaxy 15 Radio site and subreddit. In the IRC tonight, Alhazard, Cyberlard, Cycros, Madman, and myself. That's all I got. I'm going to have to stitch together where the stream crashed in the middle on us and play sound effects.
That's it, man. Game over, man.
Madman left
Game
your
over.
Channel.
Nose down and call it a night.
I'll be honest with you. I'm kind of retarded.
Shut up, Wesley.